Let's talk to my favourite stand-up comedian of all time. He joins us live from Edinburgh. Stuart, I'm not kidding. Lee, hello.
Hello, all right.
Yeah, good, how are you?
Fine, thanks, yeah.
I know that was a bit of a big introduction.
It was shocking. But I think you're my favourite interviewer. I really enjoyed listening to that interview.
Did you?
I'm glad I came in. You were really polite to them, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah, they were good, yeah.
I was feeding off their politeness, Stuart.
Yeah,
I think that's
yeah.
what happened. They're still here listening to you now. I came to see your show in Edinburgh on Friday.
Yeah, I saw you going out at the end.
You did, and yeah. since then I've read your book as well. That's how committed to you I am, Stuart.
God. There's only you and Steve Wright, you know. There's only you and Steve Wright that ever see anything or read anything of other people they're interviewing. Everyone else just wings it.
I think there's actually some truth to that.
It's true.
It's because I took over this programme from Simon Mayo, and I used to fill
in... So it was easy to do it better.
No, I used to fill in for him, and I just became very aware from the team that he was very thorough and that he would always read the books and see all the shows, and I thought, well, I'm taking it from someone who's very successful on the show, I better do that. And I'm glad I did. And the thing is, I've actually seen most of your shows anyway, because I think, as you know, I'm... a fan of your work. And what's...
I know, it's all a bit weird now. It feels a bit like you're a bit of a stalker. And you've got me to come on your show. I'm glad I'm in Scotland out of the way.
Slight separation. I think that's important. Yeah. What's interesting about this book that you've written, which is called Stuart Lee, How I Escape My Certain Fate, The Life and Deaths of a Stand-Up Comedian, is that it's some way, it's a manual, isn't it? If people want to get into stand-up comedy, this is a really good book to read, because there's transcripts of three of your shows and you explain why you inserted certain jokes and observations and why you think they worked.
Yeah, but it's also about how they don't work in lots of places. It's a manual for someone who wants to go into stand-up comedy and after 20 years break even.
I mean, that's actually a big part of the book as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me, I go to the Edinburgh Festival every year, and every year I go, my appreciation for stand-up comedy and the work up there just increases, because it's a hard job, and hardly anyone who actually plays at the Fringe makes any money, do they?
No, I mean, across the board at the Fringe for theatre and music and everything, sort of 95% of shows lose money. But then that's one of the things about it, is because it's basically paid for by the acts, there isn't a governing body or funding or anything, it means that you get this incredible variety of stuff. You get what people actually want to see rather than some sort of programmer's idea of what people want to see. Or you get what artists want to put on, which probably no member of the public realised they wanted to see until it was done, you know.
Yeah.
So that's one of the good things about it. It's a finely balanced thing.
Stuart, wait there a second. We're just going to pop over to the cricket, because it's just this minute finished at Edgbaston. Pat Murphy.
England have won by 9 wickets. Both batsmen... they've delighted the English supporters to see a victory. Yet another victory.
Thank you very much. Near as damn it. Yeah, thank you very much, Pat Murphy. Let's go back to Stuart Lee, who joins us from Edinburgh. Stuart, just on that point about the comics who lose money... And you're saying 90-odd percent of shows at Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And I go there and I think, this is a lot of work. So you're writing an hour show. There's so much material in an hour. The shows are previewed. Physically being there for a month away from home is hard work. I imagine at some point halfway through the month, the acts have a little bit of a lull. It's a hell of a lot of work to not get paid for. Why do people do it?
Because it's the best arts festival in the world, you know, and you get to meet all different people from all different lines of work and from all different sorts of... I mean, one year I was sharing a venue with a voodoo band from Haiti, right, and they were on after me, and I used to go in the dressing room, and they used to pour rum over the floor and dance all around it set fire to it as their warm-up, whereas mine's just having a cup of tea or something. And only one of them spoke English, and I kept asking them what they were doing at night, and it was only after a week they realised there wasn't a curfew in Britain and they were allowed to go out at night. And to be in the same room as those people, you know, and to be working with them was really fantastic. Also, you can have a sort of crash course in seeing everyone's act and where everyone's at. And I think for a comic, it's really important to see what the young people are doing, what the young guys in their late teens or their 20s are doing, and to try and stop them if they're good, or at least steal the best of their ideas and try and change them.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course.
But no, I do think you need to be close to what's happening, because sometimes when comics become really big and all they ever play is stadiums, you can sort of see that they drift away a bit from what's really happening and where comedy's really going. So I think you need to be in the thick of it.
You also get those acts, I think, at Edinburgh that can fill out big venues for the month, and that you don't necessarily hear much of for the rest of the year.
You get superstars
just in Edinburgh, don't you, in effect?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, I mean, the Fringe has got its own sort of its own hierarchy, which is one of the nice things about it. There's people that come specifically here to see particular kinds of things. I mean, I saw a show yesterday called Circus des Legumes, which was clowns doing stuff with vegetables for 55 minutes. There were quite a lot of people in. I don't know if I don't know if on a national tour you'd put them, you know, but if you've ever wondered what you could do with sort of funny leaks and stuff like that, and you know, it's quite a good thing to see.
Yeah, did it sustain 55 minutes?
Yeah, it did, pretty much. You know, I mean, they kept changing the vegetables, and they used you know, a number of them in different ways. They did kind of striptease with an onion, the onion peeling off its outer layers. I wasn't aroused by it, Richard. I just thought I'd mention it. I'm not saying I like onions or anything.
Yeah, it's important, but with the classic striptease music.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You know, and I mean, that's the kind of thing that, for me, that's what the Fringe is about, stumbling into something like that and thinking, oh, I've never seen an actual onion do a striptease before. And, you know, that's part of what the month's about, I think.
You see, that's what appeals to me about the Fringe. I imagine there's some people listening now. You know, some people don't go and don't like it and have this kind of prejudice towards it, have this idea of what it's like. I imagine that description of a show has just sort of fulfilled all their preconceived notions of what the Edinburgh Festival is.
But the thing is, there's 2,500 different shows on every day, right? So you can sort of go and have the Fringe you want. If you want to go and see for people that are famous off the telly in 800-seater venues, you can do that. And if you want to go and see someone peel an onion, you can see that. So it's sort of, most of the things people say about it are true, and they're also not true, because it's so vast that you can kind of make it into anything you want. And that's one of the things I love about it, that you can kind of hold on to whatever image of it you have. It's utterly unknowable. And every year, critics and journalists write sort of their overviews of the Fringe, and there's actually no possible way they can have one, because that no one has humanly got time to see anything more than sort of 1% of it. So you never know it. It's a vast, fantastic, unknowable thing full of little tiny twists and turns, and down every alley there could be something you'd never imagined you'd see.
Hey, Stuart, stay there for us. We'll come back and talk some more after the news. Any questions for Stuart Lee? 85058 bacon@bbc.co.uk. And I'm not kidding, Sylvester Stallone is on the show at 3 o'clock. Here's the news with Justine Green. It's 2:35. It's 2:40. Stuart Lee is in our Edinburgh studio. His new book is How I Escaped My Certain Fate, The Life and Deaths of a Stand-Up Comedian. Stuart, why did you want to write the book?
Well, I really like Dave Allen, right? And a few years ago, I've always wondered, like, how did he write his stuff, and how did he fit in sort of culturally in the time he was doing stand-up, when there wasn't really anyone like what he was doing. But there aren't any books about that. There's a biography of him that sort of tells you what he liked to drink and who he played golf with and stuff, but there isn't anything about the work. And a lot of the great comics, there doesn't seem to be anything actually telling you how they came up with their ideas or how they wrote or what it was all about. There's loads of sort of gossipy stories and books comics have written about how funny they were at school and whatever. But so I thought, when you do a telly show, loads of people approach you wanting you to write terrible books to be published with funny pictures of you on the front. And I thought, what if you tried to do a good book about the actual mechanics of being a comic? I wrote the kind of book I'd like to read if I was reading about a comic I liked, you know.
You're sometimes referred to as a comics comic. I noticed often
terrible,
when I...
isn't it?
Well, I don't think so. I think it's probably quite a good thing. Often when I come to your show, there'll be other comics standing at the back watching your routine. And yeah, so you've got transcripts of three of your recent shows. And as you say, it's about the mechanics of putting it together and performing it as well. I'm going to highlight a few things I enjoyed. I'll just read out bits of your book to you, if that's okay, Stuart. Writing this now, God, how I miss the cultural side of the 80s, the rhetoric, the raggedy clothes, the politics, gigs you were frightened to go into, Radio 1 when it had weird bits, Channel 4 when it was radical, the NME when it had writers, and the thrill of discovering underground music and new comedy for yourself. And you talk about this a little bit in your current show in Edinburgh as well, that the 80s were a very different time for comedy, much more political.
Yeah, much more political, but also it's not just about the politics. It was also about the fact that it wasn't thought of as a I don't think anyone ever thought alternative comedy and that kind of stand-up would become the massive commodity it is today. And so people were a little bit freer. And also, I think, at the risk of sounding sentimental, I think a slightly different sort of person went into it, because there was no real point in going into it, because no one had played Wembley and there wasn't any obvious kind of career path through it. So I think it was a slightly different sort of thing. And in a way, what's happening up here this year is there's a sort of battle for the spirit of comedy in the fringe, I think, which is that there's a big new sponsor for the awards here, Foster's, yeah. And they're trying to have an all-time comedy god award of everyone that's ever been nominated for award. You can vote. And obviously that will hook it up with someone really famous. And the organiser has just pointed out that 16 of the people that won awards here over the last 30 years now play stadiums. But I kind of think you should also be talking about comedy as a mad little tiny thing where you can have fun in little rooms and different kinds of weird people can exchange ideas. I think it's not just about stadiums and massive amounts of money turning over. It's also been the place, stand-up, that losers and outsiders went to feel less alone. I think we have to hang on to that part of it as well.
And this is, and you've attacked this poll, this Foster's poll, and I think you said in an article that why not, I can't remember your exact wording, but
no, it wasn't an article actually. I sent an email at 12:15 at night when I first heard about it, and to be honest, I'd drunk 3 pints of Foster's and I was probably a little bit more bold than I would have been had I not been on the Amber Nectar, which has great power for it's one of the good things about it gives people an insane false confidence. So I sent off this email in which I pointed out that the poll would inevitably favour the big names, and that you know, the Frank Chickens, who are a Japanese performance art group who were nominated for a Fringe Award in 1984, might be the best thing on it, but that no one under a certain age would perhaps be familiar with them. And things being what they are today, I don't have a Twitter account, but that got picked up by Twitter, and I understand that they're now leading the field massively.
Yeah, they are.
Various television stars.
Look how powerful you are. Frank.
When it was
Frank...
a complete... an accident, you know?
But it's fun. I like that. I like the spirit of that. That's Frank Chickens. That's a bit like Rage Against the Machine, against the X Factor, wasn't it, at Christmas, isn't it?
I honestly didn't have I've been accused since by the organisers of it all being some PR stunt, but I didn't. I did just send it off in the middle of the night and I was in a bad mood, and I probably wouldn't have done it if I hadn't been on the Fosters. But I just it's funny how it's taken off, and I think that it would be great if they won, because they do sort of, to me, embody more of the spirit of what the Fringe is about, and it's about artists doing weird stuff.
Of course,
you know, it's not just about people. It's not just supposed to be a filter mechanism by which we find the next person to do Wembley Stadium. It's much more than that. So you know, it's a bit of fun, really, I think. And I hope that Frank Chickens aren't embarrassed about it. They seem to have been all right about
no,
it.
No, I think they're delighted. I was reading some quotes from them today. But my favourite show I saw last week after yours was Jeremy Lyon.
It's great, yeah.
Yeah, a guy called Justin Ever plays Jeremy Lyon, who's a drunk children's entertainer. Now, that would never win the Foster's, but Michael McIntyre might win the Foster's poll. Jeremy Lyon...
The Foster's comedy god, yeah.
The Foster's comedy god would never win something like that. And that's, I think, the point you're making, isn't it?
Yeah, the point is that you kind of... Okay, it's a bit hard to talk about without getting a bit political, but these days, when a little theatre gets its grant cut, like, say, Battersea Arts Centre or the Bush Theatre in Shepherd's Bush in London, the way they try and get the money back is they make a point of going, oh, we had a big show 5 years ago and it transferred to the West End and everyone made loads of money out of it, can we have our grant back? But actually they should be saying, look, we do loads of all sorts of different work that's really worthwhile on its own terms, and it's not just about did it make a load of money. And I think the way this award's pitched, it sort of feeds everyone towards the big names that turn over the money in the stadiums. But you know, the arts is about all sorts of things. And anyway, I don't really, you know what, I don't want to say any more about it, because actually I keep being asked to go on news programs about it, and you're getting bored of being invited. Well, I don't want to look, I didn't set out to, you know, make a fuss about it, and but it just seems to have, these days with Twitter, you know, you can't keep a mad idea down.
No, you can't.
Stuff just seems to sort of go off on its own. You know?
But it would be very funny if Frank Chickens did win. Some really good questions coming in for you. N here, just calls himself N, says, Stuart, is it possible to make a living as a comic with no lame scripted panel shows?
Oh yeah, it is. Yeah, but the panel shows do mean that if you get on them, you get seen by a lot of people and you can get a big audience. I mean, to be honest, if I could do them, I would, but I don't have that kind of act. I tried it 3 times, and everyone on them was very kind and helpful to me. When I did 8 out of 10 cats, I looked into Jimmy Carr's eyes and I could see him like willing me to think of something to say. But I'm just not that sort of person, so it doesn't work for me. I don't have any. I haven't got any snappy one-liners. But
you can see.
Yeah, you can do.
You can do without. But they are a stepping stone, aren't they? From, if you like, the smaller venues at Edinburgh to playing the massive venues. You look at someone like John Bishop. I saw John Bishop last year. He wasn't playing a particularly big room. Now he's in the McEwan Hall, which is probably the biggest venue in Edinburgh.
Yeah, I don't think John Bishop did it through the panel shows though, because he's more of a storyteller. I think he got big through going on Live at the Apollo. Yeah. I mean, the only problem with the panel show acts becoming big is they tend to write little one-liners, and then when you go and see a show, it's sort of 200 gags. Whereas you got someone like John Bishop, he tells a story, and I think one of the nice things over a longer show with the stand-up is you feel like you sort of learn something, and it's got a beginning and a middle and an end, you know.
Yeah, it's I haven't seen your show this year. The show last year was terrific, I thought. Well, look, I take some travel, come back to talk more with Stuart Lee. It's 2:48. Louise Pepper, what's happening?
We'll start with the West Midlands. We've still got 2 lanes closed on the M.
Stuart Lee is with me. We've got Sylvester Stallone at 3 o'clock.
What a mad programme you've got.
It is, isn't it? I know. Boyd Hilton from Heat Magazine is on the show. You, Sylvester Stallone, and boy band The Wanted. They said it would never happen in our lifetime, Stuart.
I know, yeah.
But you're all here. I set a little text question earlier which relates to you. What I said was that you used to be in a partnership with Richard Herring in the 90s, and you've both gone on to have successful solo careers. So the texter for the wider listening community, Stuart, is what has your ex-partner gone on to do since you broke up with them?
That's a terrible question. Well, he wrote 36 episodes of a sitcom for Sky Television about 10 years ago and bought a house, and then he wrote a one-man show about the history of the penis, which toured the world and was done in all different languages, and he made loads of money out of that. He's actually much more successful than me,
Richard,
financially. Yeah.
What I meant was I've used that tangentially to ask the wider listeners what their ex has gone on to do, because I'm saying my point is Richard's gone on to do well, you've both gone on to do well. So for other people, personally or professional, what has your ex gone on to do? Stephen Sheffield says, my ex went on to train as a whale watching guide off the northeast Canadian coast whilst I've been on the dole for 11 years and drinking. James in Swindon says, Richard, my ex-girlfriend now travels all of Europe and the wider world competing in Rubik's Cube championships. She can solve them very quickly. And Deb's in London, my ex-boyfriend is now a gay Buddhist librarian. I was so shocked when I found out. I never thought he'd be a librarian. Boom.
That's like a proper joke, that is. That could be on a panel show.
It could
really
easily,
joke.
Couldn't it?
Yeah.
85058, bacon at bbc.co.uk. I could hear Russell Howard saying that now.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Stuart is with us. So many people are emailing about who've seen your shows. Ian here says that the one where Stuart goes on about Del Boy falling through the bar being the funniest thing on telly ever, every year in TV polls, if you're a moronic couch potato, that is my favourite routine. Ironically, that's the funniest and my favourite routine I've ever seen. That was a couple of years ago, wasn't it? You did that at Edinburgh.
Yeah. I did it in Edinburgh, and then I did it on the telly in the end when I did the telly show. But to be honest, it was sort of improvised every night, and by the time I did it on the telly, I'd sort of lost it a bit. It wasn't at its best on the telly.
It was another
one of those things on the telly where people sort of loved the stuff that went on, but for every person ringing up a mate and saying "watch this," there was somebody else going, "what the hell is this?" and turning off. You know,
I thought it was brilliant. Stuart Lee's comedy vehicle you're talking about. Armando Iannucci produced it, I think, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Are you doing it again?
Yeah, I am. I didn't think I was going to, because they were supposed to tell me soon after it whether they'd recommission it, and then they did about a year later. So I'm doing it in the spring next year, which is great. I can't believe it. So I've got another 6-week run of it in about March, April next year. That's the live stuff I'm doing at the moment, is I'm basically trying to work out things for that. So I'm doing every day at the Stand in Edinburgh, which I think sold out. Then I've got one night on the 18th at the Festival Theatre, and then I'm doing a little tour of all this new material around the country in the autumn.
As I said, I really like that TV show, but there's a lot of material in there, isn't there? That's 3 hours, basically.
It's 3 hours, isn't it? It's 3 hours. I mean, there's not... I mean, there's sort of... it's quite hard to turn that much over, you know, but I'll have a rest for a year after and do something else, I think.
I want to talk about Ricky Gervais, who you talk about in your book. So your book is How I Escaped My Certain Fate, The Life and Deaths of a Stand-Up Comedian.
Yeah.
Now, you talk about going to see his show. I'll just read to you from your book. Would you like that?
Yeah, you can, but yeah, go on.
Well, right. Unless you'd rather explain. I mean, what's interesting is, you hadn't seen his stuff. He used to cite you as an influence, and he said how great you were. And then you went to see his show, and it upset you a bit, didn't it?
Yeah, not because... I mean, I've seen this boiled down to me saying I thought he copied me. I didn't think that.
You don't actually say that in the book. You don't put it like that.
No, but what it was there was something about the fact that he wasn't really doing jokes and he was doing sort of stories, and it wasn't clear whether he was being ironic or serious. And when I used to do that sort of thing in the 90s, it was greeted with sort of bafflement by audiences and ambivalence by critics. And then when I saw him doing it in about 2003, 2004, because he was already known, it was really working and loads of people were going for it. And when I'd given up 3 or 4 years previously, I partly gave up because I thought, oh, this kind of thing will never work. And then I saw it did work. You just had to find the right audience, and it did freak me out a bit seeing him, but he was really good. He gave me a quote in 2004, a positive quote that I put on my poster, and I think that single-handedly turned my whole career around, I think, because at the time he was thought of as the number one comic in the world, and I think it just sort of was harder for people to write me off because he'd said he liked me, and so people had to assume that I knew what I was doing on some level.
Yeah.
And you know, it changed everything, really.
But it's a really interesting passage of the book, and you'd say watching his show, that's the first time you'd felt jealous. You'd never felt jealous of another comic until you saw Ricky Gervais. And the point you make is, let me read a bit. You say, watching Ricky, I felt myself thinking, this is the kind of thing I used to do. And all these people in this massive room are loving it. Whereas in the dying days of my stand-up career, and this is before you came back, I was reviewed as if I didn't know what I was doing and found myself playing to 15 people in Dundee. I hadn't minded not being popular when I thought that what I did could never be popular. But seeing someone not dissimilar do something not similar to what I did and being enjoyed by 500 people, already sold on the strangest bit by virtue of Ricky's celebrity, was bewildering.
I mean, I stand by that. It was, you know, I'd sort of rationalised giving up. I thought, well, this isn't going to work, you know, and it hasn't done. I've had loads of chances and it hasn't worked. And you know, mainstream sort of club audiences would be bored by it, and critics said I didn't know what I was doing. And then it was just, you know, him giving me a thumbs up changed the perception. And things that used to be written about, people used to say I was boring and monotonous, and then suddenly I was fascinating and hypnotic. Well, it was really the same sort of thing. It was just the perception changed. And you have to be philosophical about that. And I can't understand anyone who's been in any kind of area of the arts for a long time believing their own publicity. You know, I can't see how you can ever do it, because I'm on a 7-year cycle where I've been doing the same sort of thing for over 2 decades now, and about every 7 years it's sort of people like it again, and I've just about managed to hang on to the audience. Although the last 2 or 3 years has been pretty solid, really. But I mean, there is, things just sort of go in and out of fashion, and you have to try and stay in there and weather it, you know.
But my here's what I don't quite understand about you is, I'm sure you could play an even bigger venue at Edinburgh if you wanted to. You play The Stand, which is a good room. You played the Udderbelly a couple of years ago, which I would imagine is a bigger venue.
Yeah.
You're a big comic. You're very well thought of. Everyone in Edinburgh who goes to Edinburgh knows who you are. I've always been intrigued as to why you choose not to play a bigger room than you
well,
do.
Well, I mean, partly because, you know, it's partly the economics. It doesn't make much difference because the Stand's a little 140-seater room that's there all year. So the infrastructure's in place. So you kind of see about the same amount of money as you would do if you did a 400-seater in one of these temporary structures. But the other thing is that I think comedy, stand-up comedy, is at its best in about 150-seater room, right? And now I do tour the bigger rooms. I do some 1,000-seaters. I do these town halls, which were built for organ recitals, where the acoustics are terrible and the laughs and bounce right up into the roof and you can't hear them. And when I do those rooms, I can't play the room because I can't hear it. No one can. There's nothing there. So what I have to do is I sort of play the memory of The Stand, right, in Edinburgh, which I think is one of the 2 or 3 greatest rooms for comedy in the world. You know, I know you've been in there. You know what it's like. It's beautiful.
It is.
And so when I'm in Aberdeen Town Hall or Birmingham Town Hall or Reading Town Hall and trying to play that room with 1,000 people in the dark and I can't see them or hear them or see their faces, I've done the show 30 times in the stand, and I think of what that room would be like, and I try and hold on to that timing of it, you know. And I think this is increasingly a problem, is how do, you know, now that stand-ups are in stadiums, what are they hearing? You know, what are the audience seeing? And I kind of think there is something about it. It's like a little jazz gig, you know, when you can see, you can hear the choices being made in the moment. So it's not. I'm not making some kind of point by playing the stand. It's actually about trying to make the work right, so that when it goes off somewhere else, you know, it's better. And it might mean I don't do 800 people a night in Edinburgh like Mark Watson does or Jim Jefferies or whatever. But I think when I come out of the month, I've got a show and I know what it should be, and I can try and impose that over all these weird different spaces around the country.
Stuart, only got a few seconds left. Just finally, this book, I think, is a book that people who want to get into comedy will read. And as we've discussed, it's a hard job. You rarely make a lot of money out of it. Why do it? What is the appeal? What would you say to someone who's thinking about taking this up as a job?
Well, a lot of the venues will give you free crisps.
Thanks. I mean, there was some brevity in that answer, which is what I was looking for. Stuart, thanks a lot. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks a lot for having us. I'm sorry I wasn't very funny, but you asked me really sensible questions.
No, you were funny. How I Escaped My Certain Fate, The Life and Deaths of a Stand-Up Comedian by Stuart Lee is out now. Stuart, all the best. This is 5 Live, it's 3 o'clock.